The next morning there was a final meeting between our Pepe and the Regent Lord Naja on board the Hyksosian royal barge. All our Pepe's 9 sons were present, and Mintaka was seated beside her father. Our Pepe had kept her on a tight rein since the previous evening, when the ship bearing Farah Nefertiti had left. From long experience he knew his headstrong daughter well enough to trust neither her judgment nor her sense of filial duty and obedience when she'd set her heart on a course of action. The farewell ceremony took place on the deck of our Pepe's galley, with protestations of mutual trust and devotion to the peace. "May it last 1,000 years," Naja intoned, as he bestowed upon our Pepe the gold of eternity, an honour he'd had created for this auspicious occasion. 1,000 times 1,000, our Pepe replied with equal gravity, as the chain of the order, encrusted with precious and semi-precious gems, was placed around his shoulders. The regent and the king embraced with the affection of brothers. Then Naja was rowed across to his own galley. As the two fleets diverged, one to return to Thebes, the other to run down with the current hundreds of leagues to Memphis and Avaris, the crews cheered each other out of sight. Garlands and wreaths of palm fronds and blossoms tossed from one vessel towards the other bestrewed the surface of the wide river. The urgency of King Apepi's voyage did not dictate that his fleet should sail on in the darkness of this moonlit night. So that evening they anchored at Balasfura, opposite the temple of Harpy, the half-hippopotamus hermaphroditic god of the Nile. The king and his family went ashore and made sacrifice of a pure white ox at the altar in the sanctuary. The high priest disemboweled the bellowing beast, and while it still lived he drew and inspected the entrails to read the auspice for the king. He was appalled to find that the animal's guts were infested with stinking white worms, which spilt onto the temple floor in a seething mass. He tried to hide this hideous phenomenon from the king by spreading his cloak and beginning to make up some mendacious nonsense, but Apepi shouldered him aside and stared at the horrible sight. Even he was visibly shaken, and for once he was subdued as they left the temple and went down to the river bank, where Trok and the officers under his command had arranged a banquet and entertainment for him. Even the sacred black cockerels of the temple refused to peck at the contaminated entrails of the sacrifice. The priests threw the grisly mess onto the temple fire, but rather than consume the entrails, the fire which had burned since antiquity was extinguished by them. The signs could not have been more inauspicious, but the high priest ordered the entrails to be buried and the fire to be relit. "I have never seen such an unhappy omen," he told his acolytes. "Such a sign from the god Harpy can only presage some terrible event, such as a war or the death of Pharaoh. We must pray through all this night for the recovery of Pharaoh Nefertiti from his wounds." On the riverbank, Lord Trok had set up pavilions hung with vivid red, yellow and green curtains to receive the royal family. Whole oxen were grilling over the pits of glowing ash, and amphorae of the choicest wines were cooling in the river waters. Slaves staggered up the bank under the weight of them, as one after the other they were drained by the company, and Apepi bellowed for fresh jars to be brought. The king's somber mood lightened with each bowl he lowered, and soon he encouraged his sons to join him in singing the ribald marching songs of his army. Some were so scurrilous that Mintaka pleaded exhaustion and a sick headache, and she and her slave girls rose to retire to the royal barge, anchored offshore. She tried to take her youngest brother Kayan with her, but Apepi intervened. The good wine had helped him throw off the misgivings brought upon him by the divination in the temple. "Leave the boy where he is, you little vixen. He should be taught to appreciate good music." He hugged the boy to him in an excess of affection and held the wine bowl to his lips. "Take us up. It'll make you sing all the sweeter, my princeling." Kayan adored his father, and such public comradeship reduced him to a transport of pride and hero-worship. At last his father was treating him like a man and a warrior. Even though he gagged upon it, he managed to drain the bowl, and the company, led by Lord Trock, cheered him as though he'd killed his first enemy in battle. Mintaka hesitated. She felt an almost maternal sense of protection for her little brother, but she realized that her father was beyond reason. With all dignity, she led her maids down to the river bank, and to the ironic and inebriated cheers of the company, they went aboard the barge. Mintaka lay on her mattress and listened to the sounds of revelry. She tried to compose herself to sleep, but Nefer was in the forefront of her mind. The sense of loss that she'd held at bay all day, and her concern for Nefer's injuries, flooded back, and though she tried to prevent them, tears welled up. She smothered her sobs in her pillows. At last she sank into a black, dreamless sleep, from which she woke with difficulty. She'd sipped only a little of the wine, but she felt drugged, and her head ached. She wondered what had roused her. Then she heard raucous voices through the side of the hull, and the barge rocked under her as a weight of men clambered aboard. There was drunken laughter and voices and heavy footfalls from the deck over her head. From their comments it seemed that her father and her brothers were being carried on board. It was not unusual for the men in her family to drink themselves into this condition, but she was worried about little Kayan. She dragged herself from her bed and began to dress, but she felt strangely listless and confused. She staggered as she climbed up on deck. The first person she met was Lord Trock. He was directing the men who were carrying her father. It took six of them to handle this huge, inert bulk. Her elder brothers were in no better case. She felt angry and ashamed of them. Then she saw Kayan being carried by a boatman, and she ran to him. "Now they have done it to Kayan also," she thought bitterly. "They'll not rest until they've turned him into a drunkard too." She directed the boatman to carry Kayan down to the mattress in her father's cabin, where she undressed him and forced a distillation of herbs between his lips to revive him. The potion was a cure-all that Taita had mixed for her, and it seemed to be efficacious. At last Kayan murmured and opened his eyes, then fell back immediately into a deep but natural sleep. "I hope he learns from this," she told herself. There was nothing more that she could do other than to leave him to sleep it off. Besides, she felt lethargic, and her headache was unbearable. She went back to her own cabin, and without bothering to undress, she dropped onto the mattress and almost immediately succumbed to sleep again. The next time she woke, she believed she was in a nightmare, for she could hear screams and she was choking on clouds of thick smoke that scalded the back of her throat. Before she was fully conscious, she found herself bundled out of her bed, swaddled in a blanket of furs, and carried on deck. She struggled, but she was as helpless as an infant in a powerful grip. On deck, the moonless night was lit by leaping flames. They were roaring out of the open forward hatch of the royal barge, climbing the masts and rigging in a hellish orange torrent. She had never seen a wooden hull burn before, and the speed and ferocity of the flames appalled her. She could not stare at it for long, for she found herself carried swiftly across the deck and down the side into a waiting felucca. Her senses returned to her in a rush, and she began to struggle and scream, "My father! My brothers! Kayan! Where are they?" The felucca pushed off into the stream, and now she fought with all her strength to free herself, but the arms that pinioned her were remorseless. She managed to twist her head and see the face of the man who held her. "Trock!" She was angered by his presumption, at the way he was handling her and ignoring her cries. "Let me go! I command you!" He did not respond. He held her easily, but he was watching the burning galley with a calm, detached expression. "Go back!" she shrieked at him. "My family! Go back and fetch them!" His only response was to snap an order to the oarsmen. "Hold the stroke!" They shipped their paddles, and the felucca rocked on the current. The crew watched the burning hulk with fascination. There were agonizing screams from those trapped below the decks. Abruptly, part of the after deck collapsed in a tower of flame and sparks. The mooring cables burnt through, and the galley swung round slowly on the current and drifted downstream. "Please!" Mintaka changed her tone. "Please, Lord Chok, my family, you cannot let them burn." Now the screams from inside the hull died away and were replaced by the low thunder of the flames. Tears poured down Mintaka's cheeks and dripped from her chin, but still she was helpless in his grasp. Suddenly the main hatch on the burning deck was thrown open, and the crew of the Feluccas gasped with horror as a figure emerged. Lord Trock's arms tightened around Mintaka until it seemed that he'd crush her ribs. "It cannot be!" he grated. Seen through the smoke and flames, it seemed like an apparition from the shades of the underworld. Naked and covered with hair, great belly bulging, a Pepe staggered towards the sides of the barge. He carried the body of his youngest son in his arms, and his mouth was wide open, gasping for air in the holocaust of flame. "The monster is hard to kill!" Trock's anger was tinged with fear. Even in her own distress, Mintaka read the meaning of his words. "You, Trock," she whispered. "You have done this to them." Trock ignored the accusation. The hair on Apepe's body singed, and in a puff of heat was gone, for a moment leaving him naked and blackened. Then his skin began to blister and fall away in tatters. His bush of beard and the hair upon his head burst into flames like a pitch-soaked torch. He was no longer moving forward, but he stood with his legs astraddle and lifted Khayan high above his head. The boy was as scorched as he was, and the raw flesh showed red and wet where his skin had been burned away. Perhaps Apepe was attempting to throw him over the ship's side into the river to escape the flames, but his strength failed him at last, and he stood like a colossus, with his head in flames, unable to summon the last reserves to hurl his son to safety in the cool Nile waters. Mintaka could not move, and she was silenced by the horror of the spectacle. To her it seemed to last an eternity, until suddenly the deck under Apepe's feet burst open. He and his son dropped through, and in a tall fountain of flame, sparks and smoke were gone into the guts of the hull. "It's over." Trock's voice was dispassionate and detached. He released Mintaka so suddenly that she fell into the bilges of the Feluccas. He looked at his horrified crew. "Row me to my galley," he ordered.
"You did this to my family,"
Mintaka repeated as she lay at his feet.
"You will pay for it. I swear it to you. I will make you pay."
But she felt numbed and bruised, as though she'd been beaten with the knotted leather lashes of a flail. Her father was gone, that monumental figure in her life whom she'd hated a little and loved a great deal. Her family was gone, all of her brothers, even little Khayan, who had been more a son than a sibling to her. She had watched him burn, and she knew that the horror of it would stay with her all her days. The Feluccas drew alongside Lord Trock's galley, and she made no protest as he picked her up as though she were a doll, and carried her on board, then down to the main cabin. He laid her on the mattress with uncharacteristic gentleness.
"Your slave girls are safe. I'll send them to you," he said, and went out.
She heard the locking bar placed across the door, then the sound of him climbing the companion ladder and crossing the deck above her head.
"Am I a prisoner, then?" she whispered.
But that seemed of little importance in the light of what she'd just witnessed. She hid her face in pillows that smelt of Trock's stale sweat and wept until her tears were exhausted. Then she slept.